There is a sacredness in tears. They are not the mark of weakness, but of power. They speak more eloquently than 10,000 tongues. They are the messengers of overwhelming grief, of deep contrition, and of unspeakable love. Washington Irving. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 12 of Emetophobia Help. I'm Anna Christie, recovered emetophobic licensed psychotherapist specializing in emetophobia, and your host for this podcast. Today, we're going to be talking to Melina, who's from Vernon in Western Canada. We're going to be talking about her beautiful and heart-wrenching story that certainly contributed to her emetophobia. Trigger warnings, we do say the word vomit. I think throw up might be said at one point. And Melina does tell us a story of her getting sick as a child on a subway. I mean, she doesn't use any graphic gore detail or anything. But if you are sensitive to just the stories themselves, that's kind of what this podcast is about. So maybe you can listen to it anyway. If you get triggered, and just breathe through it and take away the wonderful inspiration that Melina gives you. So, hi, Melina.
Hi, Anna.
How are you?
I'm doing really well. It's lovely to meet you, and thank you for having me.
That's no problem. You got your little personal, what is it, a dog? assistant dog.
Yeah, he's just a puppy, and he loves to be wherever I am. So he's so planted cute, himself on my lap.
Well, Melina and I can see one another, but of course, those of you listening are just going to have to imagine a cute little, is he a Shih Tzu or something like
no,
that?
No, he's called a Cavachon. He's a Cavalier Bichon, and just the sweetest little guy ever.
Cavachon. Very cute. Why don't we start out by having you talk a little bit about your early life as a child growing up and how this emetophobia started.
Okay. Well, I grew up in New York City in Manhattan, in Washington Heights. And I grew up in a Jewish household, not practicing and not religious, but very culturally Jewish, meaning that it was a very loud house. very kind of frenetic. I'm an only child, and there were always lots of expectations placed on me to succeed and achieve. And I was a little bit of a mischievous kid, and that's a streak I think that has just carried on all through life. So I would get in trouble for lots of different things and always be kind of testing my boundaries. And I think the one person that I kind of gravitated toward the most in my childhood was my grandmother. And she was called Bubby in Yiddish. Mm-hmm. Grandmother is Bubby. And, I was actually born in Argentina, and my parents moved back from Buenos Aires to New York when I was about a year old, and they both had to go right back to work. So I was in my grandmother's care throughout the week, and she was really the person with whom I spent the most time. And I just adored her, and she adored me. And I was the first grandchild of what would eventually be five. So I was kind of the golden grandchild. And she took care of me. We spent all of our time together. And it seemed like whenever I'd be in trouble with my parents, my very loud and somewhat abrasive parents, my father is Argentine, so he has a very fiery Latin temper and big yeller, not a big shower of emotion. That's just not something that was ever done in my family. My grandmother was the person who would always kind of be there to reassure me that I was, you know, good, and that she loved me no matter what. And it was just a very sacred, special relationship. And I adored her. And I remember at the end of the week when I would have to go back to my own apartment with my parents, I never wanted to go. I just wanted to stay with my grandmother forever. And so when I was seven, close to eight, she was diagnosed with a brain tumor, with brain cancer. And it was a glioblastoma. So yeah, kind of the worst kind.
Yeah.
And it was all very, very sudden. She did admit to the family that she'd been having headaches and such for several years, but kind of never, she was just a very selfless person, mm-hmm. never wanted to worry anybody. It was always about the grandkids and the family. And so she kind of just ignored symptoms for a very long time. And when she finally was too sick to ignore it, she was actually on her way in downtown Manhattan picking up a game for me, a board game that I desperately wanted and my parents refused to buy for me. And so she was on her way to get this game, and it was only in one store, and she had to, you know, go take three subways or something to get it. And when she was coming home with the game on the subway back to Washington Heights, to our neighborhood, she fell, and because she had lost her balance, and then was admitted to the hospital and never came out of the hospital. So they opened up her brain and took one look and said, this is beyond anything we can do at this point. And she died within a few days. And it was,
oh no.
Yeah. It was like very, my first brush with death, and my first, you know, big loss that has shaped everything moving forward in my life. So the story around the emetophobia is my mother took me and my two younger cousins to go visit her, to visit Bubby in the hospital. Again, I was about between seven and 8 years old. And we took the subway down. And I remember that, you know, I don't know what really is actually real memory and what's mm-hmm. kind of just been conjured over all these years. But what I remember is that we were in the lobby of the hospital, one of the big New York hospitals, mm-hmm. and we weren't allowed upstairs to see her because we were too young. So somebody wheeled her down in a wheelchair to the lobby, and she just looked so not like the Bubby mm-hmm. I basically was raised by for those 7-8 years. And I remember, you know, I started to cry, and she took my hand and she pulled me close and she said, you know, Melly, that's what she called me. Don't cry. I don't want you to be sad. Everything's going to be okay. And we hugged. And then that was the last time that I saw her. And so that day after we'd seen her, my mother, who was obviously very distraught herself, but trying to hide it for the sake of the kids, myself and my two younger cousins, she took us all around Manhattan, and we went and we ate everything all over the city. We had popcorn and candy, and we went through Central Park and had lemonade and peanuts and, you know, all this stuff, because it's a very Jewish thing to just feed people when things are right. not going well. I do it all the time.
A few different cultures have oh, that. Yeah. yeah.
Just ask yeah. my son and my husband. Anyway, so we were taking the subway back from downtown. It was the A train back to our stop. And probably a 20-minute subway ride. And I remember feeling very sick, but also just very sad because of Bubby and how she had looked. At this point, I didn't know that it was the last time I would see her. But I remember leaning over to my mom. It was a very crowded subway. It was rush hour. And I said, I don't feel well. And she said, oh, it's okay. You'll be fine. We're almost there. And then just before we got to our stop, I got sick all over the subway, all over myself. And I remember all the people in the subway car looking. And my mother, who I guess at that moment, I just needed her to say, you know, it's okay. Like, we're all sad. And right. Bubby's dying, and we need to talk about our feelings. Well, she, you know, she was grieving herself. And so she got so angry at me for like adding this extra layer of inconvenience to an already terrible day. Right. And I remember she just sort of grabbed my arm and pulled me off the subway and I was, you know, all dirty and my cousins were horrified. And that was the last time I was ever sick. And from then on, I just developed this, you know, to varying levels over the and degrees over the last 30 plus years, this fear of being sick, and haven't been since. And so that's sort of the history of it. And I've had, go ahead.
No, that's you don't look that old to me, but you're old. It's been.
Yeah, I'm 45. Yeah.
Okay. So, oh my gosh. Okay. So that's been, like 37 years or something.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I always try to bring humor to everything, partially because I'm an entertainer, I think. So my little joke, if anyone ever asks me, is vomit free since 83.
Oh, gosh.
Which is a big trigger for people I know who like really suffer. And I do suffer, but I can't live my life without the humor aspect of it. So
exactly. Yeah, I understand that too. A lot of people have these sort of accounting of the years that they are kind of a lot of people are quite proud of their number of how many years have gone by. But I always tell them, no, don't be proud of that number. Be proud of it's only been 5 minutes or something.
I know.
Like it's better to be sick all the time than it is to never be sick. But my husband's not even, he's not emetophobic in the least. He never did a thing to not catch germs or be sick or anything. And he didn't vomit for 32 years.
Oh, wow.
And then it was so random.
Yeah.
And that was almost 10 years ago. Yeah. So some people are just don't get sick.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me. I'm definitely not proud of it at all. And believe me, over the years there, I wish that I didn't have this hang up, you know, and this fear, because it's definitely diminished the quality of my life in a lot of ways. So,
I can well imagine that. Why don't you talk a little bit about the ways in which, just briefly, it has diminished the quality of your life?
Well, I remember if I go back to sort of that pivotal day and that time, of course I wouldn't have known as a 7 or 8 year old, nor would my parents, that I was in the throes of developing this phobia that would kind of persist for my whole life. But I just remember, I just remember that the next sort of thing that happened over the next few years is that I would try to, very weird, I would try to make my friends feel sick and need to throw up. I remember I would want to, I became very careful about what I ate. So I never ate any of the things that we ate on that day again for years and years and years. So I became this sort of health nut at age 7, and no junk food. And because I associated junk food, all the kind of crap that we'd eaten that day to what happened. But when my friends would come over, I would feed them all of those things that I had eaten that day that I wasn't allowing myself to eat anymore, just sort of hoping that I think looking back now, because I've done a lot of work and a lot of thinking and therapy and journaling about all this over the decades, I think I just wanted to feel less alone in how I was feeling. I wanted somebody close to me. My friends were the closest I had. I didn't have siblings, to sort of experience a little bit of what I had gone through or was going through. And of course that never really happened. And if any of my friends ever did get sick, nobody made a big deal of it. I seem to be the only one who just thought it was, this life or death kind of thing. And to this day, if somebody asks me, or if I question myself, like, would you rather throw up or would you rather die? I actually equate being sick to dying.
Right. Yeah.
So over the years, whenever I have felt sick, and I've had the stomach flu, I've had a child, so I've had morning sickness. I even had salmonella poisoning. And anytime I've ever felt like it was going to happen, to me, there's no difference between that and dying. Like, to me, right. It feels like I will die.
Exactly. Even though you know you won't die, you feel as though you're going to die. It's extremely frightening. I think a lot of people who don't have any kind of anxiety disorder, they never had a panic attack, they don't understand. They think it's just something that you're scared of, like a movie. It feels like impending death right that second.
It does.
And people are like, you're not going to die. It's just fine. You know, and they're like, and you're like, yeah, I know that, but there's actually part of your brain that doesn't know.
Yeah.
Doesn't know that you're not going to die. Yeah.
So true. Like, I've never experienced panic the way I have and do when I feel nauseous. And so to me, it needs to be avoided at all costs. And I kind of have my body so like kind of regimented and practiced as to what to do when I ever feel, you know, even the initial signs of it. And I'll take all the antiemetics and I'll drug myself to, you know, almost to a stupor, and I'll put on a specific TV show. And so there's where kind of like some of the OCD stuff will happen, right? I need to be in a certain place. I need to have fresh air blowing on my face. So all kinds of things. And the rest of the world just ceases to exist completely when I'm in those moments. But on the other hand, because I'm so kind of rehearsed at my routine, it's almost like my body just like snaps right into like go mode, you know, like I'm an opera singer by trade, and I almost relate it to, you know, my voice is so rehearsed and so practiced that it can perform under, you know, the most insane circumstances. And it's almost like this nausea thing, the same sort of thing happens because I've trained it and I've honed it over so many years. But it takes a lot of energy and work.
It really does. And you were listing out what we call safety behaviors, where people have, I need this, I need the fresh air, I need this drug, or, you know, over the counter, whatever it is, ginger, peppermint. I've got a 3 pages long list of potential, you know, things I've heard from people that are safety behaviors. And they make you feel a little bit better in that moment, but they do make your phobia worse over time, or at least they continue it. They make it go on and on and on and on without resolution. So, I'm going to send you a workbook that I just finished writing for my clients. Maybe it'll be helpful. Yeah, you might find a few things in there. But you're such an interesting and delightful person. And, you know, part of me wishes I was doing YouTube, but I can't take 2 hours to get my hair and makeup to look like what you did in probably 10 minutes. You're so beautiful. Oh my goodness.
Thank you, Anna.
Anyway, I feel very, very old, but I love the podcast
thing. You look wonderful. You know,
I just want to say I was trying to remember what to say before, but that story you tell about your bubby is so incredibly sad. Like, that is such a sad story. And to have it so clearly linked to that vomiting episode on the subway is, you know, a lot of people, I think the very first podcast, well, the first one, I just told my story, but I think episode 2 is all about like a woman who was just kind of going nuts trying to find the cause. What's the cause? What's the cause? Because a lot of people don't have stories like that. You know, they don't even have any story, and maybe something happened to them when they were pre-verbal, you know, like before age five that you don't really remember. But with you, I mean, your Bubby was like your mother figure. You know, she was the one that you felt secure with and bonded to, and you didn't want to go home on the weekends, you know. Yeah. Nothing against your mother, of course, but she took that role, and then she was just snapped away from you like almost instantly. And then, of course, to have this happen to you on the subway, and your mother to get upset because, of course, your mother, your poor mother, was grieving her mother, you know. But it all kind of worked together in a perfect storm.
For sure.
Yeah, you've had quite a few different therapies you were listing out. Have you ever had EMDR?
Now, which?
That's the eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
No, I have not.
Yeah, that's something you might want to look into. People that have specific, like an incident, like a story like that, a happening, EMDR can be really helpful. And it's not a form of therapy in the sense that you have to already be a therapist, you have to be licensed, and then you go and you take EMDR training. And it's done a number of different ways, but they used to wave their fingers, you know, in front of you. Every podcast, I demonstrate something with my hands. I think that for those of you who are listening that have heard me, every time you could start writing them down, I should be giving away a prize. What did Anna demonstrate with her hand? Anyway.
It's hard to remember.
So the idea is to get your eye movement to go back and forth, your right and left brain, so that you go get beyond the thinking brain and back into where these memories and emotions are stored and kind of fixed together and be able to process them out. It works quite well. It works with PTSD with soldiers and things like that. They can do it with your ears. Like you can do it online with audio now, one ear than the other, and even tapping. If you're in person, my therapist did tapping on my knees alternately, and it's not a cure for emetophobia. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah,
but it would help to ravel out some of that. And help you to process it, because at 7 years old, there was a lot to process there.
Yeah.
You know, it was probably really difficult. But you were saying that you're an opera singer. Do you ever get thoughts in your head when you're performing about, oh no, what if I vomit now? Like, do you ever get that?
This is a big one. Huge, huge, huge. Mm. Yes, I do. And it, for many years, it went away when I was on stage. And then actually just in the last year, I was involved in a very big, national tour, a high profile kind of thing, which would be continuing right now, of course, if we weren't in these times. And just kind of in right smack in the middle of a performance, and I've been doing this for, you know, my whole life, I had that horrible, like, oh my gosh, what if I'm actually, this sounds so silly, but what if I'm actually nauseous right now and I'm just ignoring it because I'm busy doing my thing on stage? And it just snowballed in my head, and I had to employ every technique that I have, and because I'm a professional at this, I was able to. Nobody would have known what was going on, but it really threw me, and it really undermined my confidence, and I had to really work through it in a lot of ways. And that used to happen to me quite a bit when I was in school in New York. I studied at Juilliard. And it was a pretty wretched 4 years as far as the emetophobia was concerned, for whatever reason, maybe just the stress, being away from home, living on my own for the first time. It got really bad. And I actually, after I finished school and moved to Canada, I actually stopped singing for about a year, because I thought I can't do this. I can't live like this. Right. I have to live a less stressful life, and being a performer is certainly not that. But I slowly kind of worked myself back because I believe this is kind of my calling and what I'm meant to do. And, but it definitely has affected me career-wise. And in all honesty, having this break from singing is making me nervous about when my career and my shows resume, because I'm a little bit afraid of that happening again, just because it came so out of the blue. I'm very much like, I really need to understand things. I need to research and get it and know what the causes are. And just that helps me. And so the fact that that just sort of happened on stage for no apparent reason, I don't like that. It makes me very, very nervous.
Well, you know, I can relate a little bit in that I was a United Church minister for about 25 or 30 years, depending on when you start counting. But the 30 years of being in church on a Sunday, which is like synagogue on a Saturday, you're like the rabbi, you're standing up there. You're the only one standing up there. I mean, there you have a few breaks. There are readers and there are hymns and choirs are singing and so on. But you give a sermon, you've got 15 to 20 minutes. It's just you. And I remember those thoughts creeping in one time and I was just panicking. And the next week when I stood up, I started to get that feeling again. And I just said, oh, no, you don't. Like, no, you will not ruin this for me. Like, I've never been nervous ever up in front of people. Just ask me to get up and talk about some random topic in front of 10,000, but I don't care. It doesn't matter. I never got nervous. I just kind of said, no, you won't do this to me. And, and that worked. Like so it's a little tip. I don't know.
That's a wonderful tip.
For you. But I was mad, you know. I was like, no, you ruin all kinds of other things in my life. You're not going to ruin this too, you know, because so.
I'm going to try that, Anna. I think it's a great tip.
Just give it the girl power, you know. I'm sure, guys, if you're listening, give it the guy power. But, you know, just sometimes you just have to say stop it, you know, because these are obsessive thoughts. They're not reality. They're not real. They're just anxiety. And every time you say the words, what if, in your head, that's a warning signal that your anxiety is you, because you're thinking about a future that you don't know exists. Yeah. You don't know. Like, what if I'm sick? That's something that what that happens in the next, you know, it's in the future. It's a few minutes from now. You got to concentrate on the here and now. And I think if you're singing, I mean, if you sing opera, you're also waiting to sing, right? That's the thing, right? You're waiting for other people and then you sing. So, but like right now I can hear so-and-so. Right now I can see, you know, so just get in the here and now, this moment right now, or right now I'm singing, you know?
Yeah.
Because I'm sure a lot of it's automatic, but that's really interesting. I think that that'll be a great, it's a great story for our listeners to hear. You're a very courageous person to, you know, I think any emetophobic who has, you have a relationship, you have a child, you have a career, you're a performer. I mean, this is amazing. You're very inspiring.
Thank you.
And I will send you that workbook because, you know, I think you could, I know you've tried a few different therapists and therapies, but I had to try 10 therapists before I found one that could help me. And a lot of those 10 were horrible to me. Like they were not just unhelpful. They were actually like, there's something wrong with you and you don't care and you don't want to get better and call me when you want to face your fear. And, you know, I've talked about quite a few of those. And those people are still out there around and about, but so thank you so much, Melina. You've been an amazing guest with a great story and very inspirational, so thanks for joining us today.
Me too, it was a pleasure.
Well, a big thank you to all of our listeners. We've had almost 3,000 podcast downloads now. So thank you so much. This is going really well. There are costs associated with the podcast. So if you find it helpful, you can buy me a coffee. Just look down to the bottom of the notes on this episode. You'll see a link right there to buy me a coffee. I encourage you all as well to go to my website at www.emetophobiahelp.org. It has a ton of information for emetophobics and all the resources you need as a therapist to treat emetophobia with traditional CBT. I'll be back next week, and until then, stay safe and be kind to one another.